is the 7th of August 2015. My name is Clara Valencia-Cook and I'm here with Nicholas Sims recording an oral history as part of the LSE 120th anniversary. Nicholas, can you state your date of birth and your full name for me, please?
Yes, Nicholas Alan Sims, 18th of June 1945. First of October 1968, and I worked for exactly 42 years, and I retired on the 30th of September 2010.
What was your first impression of campus? What did you first think?
I was so pleased to be here. I wouldn't have minded what the campus looked like. But it was very different from now, and one of the things about it that I rapidly discovered was how busy it is in the evenings. We worked very long hours. And in the evenings, the newspaper vans would be scurrying out of Strand House to Fleet Street because Strand House, where the Lionel Robbins building is now, was then the main newsprint distribution depot for W.H. Smith. And, of course, Clare Market and Houghton Street weren't pedestrianised. And so it was you took your life in your hands because there were these vans speeding along with the first editions out of W.H. Smith. The school was trying to get the place pedestrianised from as early as 1959, I think, but it took a very long time because although Westminster City Council wanted it pedestrianised, the wider London County Council, then Greater London Council, didn't. So it took a very long time.
What did you, when you first came here, what did you come here to do?
Well, I came here to do what I did for the 42 years, which was to teach international relations. I discovered this wonderful subject, and I was enjoying it as a student, and I wanted to help other people to enjoy it. It was a bit evangelistic, if you like. I wanted to spread the good news of international relations and enthuse students, as I myself had been enthused. And when jobs appeared, I applied for two jobs that were advertised in the Times, two assistant lectureships in international relations. And LSE was the one that replied, and I interviewed me and gave me the job. And that was wonderful. And I've been so fortunate to have been able to work here for 42 years.
And what were the students like to teach?
Right, the students. Well, they were very good from the start, but very different from now. They were overwhelmingly male. They were overwhelmingly British if they were undergraduate, and almost entirely North American if they weren't. The proportions, the numbers overall were different. Particularly, we didn't have so many postgraduate students then. That's where the main expansion took place, particularly in the 1980s, under financial pressures, and continued ever after. So a huge number of master's degree programs and diploma programs came into existence while I was here, but particularly in the 1980s and continuing, I think, up to the present day. So when I started in 1968, there weren't so many postgraduates, and as I say, they came overwhelmingly from the United States and Canada, very few from Europe at that time, very few British, because, and this was one of the things that was so exciting about tutoring undergraduates, you had to fit everything into their 3 years. It was very intensive because the expectation was that that was the highest education they'd ever receive because there wasn't a tradition of British students going on to master's degrees. There wasn't funding for it. There wasn't the expectation of it. And most of the big recruiters were recruiting people with bachelor's degrees rather than master's.
And did you find it an intellectually stimulating environment?
Dauntingly so, yes. I was very much in awe of the LSE. I think I still am. And the first thing I did when LSE replied to my expression of interest and sent me an application form and summoned me for interview was to go down to the nearest public library, which was in Stoke Newington Church Street, and read the LSE calendar to see who my future colleagues would be, if I were fortunate enough to be appointed, and what they were teaching, and how international relations was divided up into international institutions and foreign policy analysis and all the rest. So I had no knowledge, really, of how international relations was taught at the LSE, and that's what I needed to acquire. I was also very much in awe of the place because so many of the people who had just been names on the spines of textbooks, ACL Day's Introduction to Monetary Economics, for instance, turned out to be flesh and blood characters one met in the senior common room and became colleagues on committees, and one saw them at the academic board. So it was partly because I knew them as distinguished authors and scholars in all sorts of subjects, from economics to history, that Matthew Anderson, The Eastern Question, which I'd studied for International History 1815 to 1914, is another example, that these were people who had actually become my colleagues. That was very... It made a great impression on me. It was also rather daunting.
And has that been one of the highlights over the years of working at LSE, working with these distinguished colleagues?
Not so much as the students. It's the students that really made the place. I've been very fortunate with colleagues as well, but I came here overwhelmingly to enthuse students. I should say about my interview that I was only 1 year from having got my bachelor's degree, so I didn't have a long list of publications. I hadn't started on any research or anything like that. So I think what got me the job was my enthusiasm for teaching and my ideas for how to communicate international relations. And one of the things that I've most enjoyed was the fact that we had such an emphasis, certainly in the international relations department, on the tutorial relationship. And so I had to start off with 14 or 15 undergraduate tutees, a smaller number of master's degree people to whom I was their supervisor, and I was directing their studies and with a certain amount of pastoral role, but mainly the academic advisor role, as I think it's now called. This was looking at their studies in the round and trying to see them develop intellectually, trying to make sure they got a really good education out of LSE from all the different departments. So that was what I valued most, and I was extremely fortunate in the students that I had over the years, both the undergraduates and the increasing number of postgraduates.
Has it been quite gratifying to see these students go on to do other things after LSE?
Yes, it has, tremendously so. And a great variety, and some of them in public office and prominent and getting into who's who and the honours lists and so on, and others doing very humble avocations which are of at least equal value, speech therapists developing communication with severely handicapped children, for instance, I think is one of the most useful things that any of my former tutees is doing. But yes, it's wonderful to see what they're all doing. Right. Well, I think they're outweighed by all the positives, but will you ask me that next?
Yes.
Okay, right. The challenges, I think the biggest challenge probably has been the crumbling away of two of the contexts which were most important to me in the early years that I was at LSE, in the late 1960s and early 70s. We were still very much part of the University of London. That was an important context to me, particularly because my degree is from the University of London, not from LSE. And the second was the English education system, that we were then very much more part of a recognisable education and higher education system for England than LSE has become since. I think that was important to me partly because of my personal circumstances. My wife started as a school teacher just when I started as a university teacher, both in September 1968. Most of our friends were either teachers or university teachers, often married, as we were, university teacher and school teacher, or they were civil servants in the Department of Education or in other ways involved with the education system in England. So it was a challenge to try to keep LSE, so far as I could, part of those two contexts. And it was a bit of a rearguard action, particularly with regard to the University of London, which became a looser and looser confederation. LSE, like the other colleges, acquired ever greater autonomy and took all the decisions for itself. But it was very important to me to become a recognised teacher of my own University of London in 1971, and then an appointed teacher when I got my readership in 2002. And I comforted myself with the thought that even if LSE was foolish enough to leave the university, as Imperial College did in 2006, to my mind an extraordinarily stupid way of marking its centenary, even if LSE were ever stupid enough to go down that route, I would still be a graduate of the University of London. It would still be very important to me. The main highlights, that against all expectations, international relations remained a department on its own. It resisted the temptation either to take over other weaker departments or to merge into, for instance, the Department of Government. So there was sensible cooperation, very close liaison at times over joint degree programmes especially, with other departments, and of course with institutes and centres as those developed, including the European Institute. But the department retained its own independence, and that I think was tremendously important. In the same way, LSE has been unusual among the larger colleges of the University of London in not being acquisitive. We've seen University College, King's College, Queen Mary College, and particularly Imperial College, while it was still in the University of London, taking over smaller colleges and institutes. I don't think they've benefited. I think of Y College down in Kent, which Imperial took over and then scrapped. LSE didn't do that. LSE was not taken over and did not take over, and that, I think, is one of the very positive things. And the third thing I would say is the mixture of tasks that fell to the university teacher as understood at LSE, that we were to teach, we were to research, we were to be on committees and do administration, we were to advance scholarship in our particular discipline or subject, we were to be educationalists, we were to be personal tutors, we were to be class teachers, lecturers, seminar leaders. I did all those things. Oh, and research supervisor, of course, for PhD students. I did all of those things, so PhD supervision only when I was sufficiently senior. And that, to me, was a great part of the job satisfaction, that there was so much variety, and I didn't feel that I was being corralled into one task to the exclusion of the others, which I think might have happened if I'd joined later, perhaps, or if I'd been at a different university. But in my particular department in LSE, I felt encouraged to advance in all those tasks and try and do all of them to the best of my ability, and that is something I really enjoy. The one thing I didn't enjoy that I haven't mentioned, but is of course an important task of every academic, is being an examiner and marking essays and examinations, and that is one thing I'm very, very happy to have left behind, because that was a necessary task, but it's not one that I ever enjoyed. Well, in the early years, certainly, it was very well attended. I remember it needed a larger venue than the boardroom it used at that when I started was what is now the Vera Anstey room. It moved to the what is about to be knocked down in the Clare Market building, C120, as a new boardroom. That was just about big enough, but occasionally we needed the new theatre in the East Building, which is enormous, because the academic board, I think since the 1930s, had been opened up to full-time academic staff, even assistant lecturers, as I was in my first year. And people thought it really worthwhile, and it was, of course, in charge of most of the committees, but it also took a lot of decisions on its own account, by delegation, I think, from the court and what eventually became the council as the governing body. But I do think it was a very important. It seemed a very important body. I certainly took it very seriously, and I think a lot of other people did. And over the years, I continued to attend it. But towards the end, departments were being urged to make sure that at least two people attended it, and I thought that was very sad. When I'd started, we were a department of 14 academic staff, and there was no difficulty finding people to go along. When I finished, we were a department of 33 or 34 academic staff, and I was happy to volunteer, but they had to find somebody else to go along because people were so unenthusiastic by that time. For various reasons, the academic board seemed to have become less important, and I think there'd been a movement towards departmentalisation anyway. So for a lot of people, their department or their centre or institute was what mattered rather than the LSE as a whole. And certainly that's how it felt to me, that that had evolved. But it was easier in 1968 because there were only 13 departments. And there was a great deal of, it was a much smaller campus anyway, and we saw much more of one another. Most of us were teaching within the same degree structure, the BSc Econ, which had been set up in 1900 and lasted till, I think, 1995. And we were special subjects within that structure. So that was one of the things. I wouldn't say that's the most important thing, but that was one of the things that, that held us together as an LSE community. But it was a smaller campus.
It's interesting you should say that, because other faculty have also said that when they first started, that there was a lot more interaction also in the senior common room and the staff dining room, partly because there wasn't access to kitchens in people's different departments, so for a cup of tea you'd have to go to the senior common room. Did you find that you were often there and you often met people in the senior common room?
Yes, I think that's true, yes, but probably mainly lunchtimes. I found the senior common room, as an emeritus reader, which I am now, one of its privileges is to enjoy life membership of the senior common room, having paid subscriptions to it for 42 years and always been rushing through it far too fast on my way to a committee or a seminar or a lecture. It's lovely to be there with leisure these days, so I'm really enjoying SCR membership. But yes, I think we did meet particularly over lunchtime. And in my case, I got to know people from other departments particularly because I enjoyed serving on committees, which not all academics do, to put it mildly. And I did, and I made some very good friends among colleagues in other departments. And having served with them on committees, seen them in the academic board, it was then easier to work with them in lots of other contexts after that. There are so many of them. The place is just full of memories, and the lecture theatre that I used most, which in Connaught House is now a Department of Finance PhD student's room, because I came past it on my way here. But I have very happy memories of that and of some other places. Having lunch in Wright's Bar, I think of that as the one thing that hasn't changed. I was asking the proprietor, who's been there since 1975, when it dates from, and he thinks 1944. And with so many other changes on the campus, Wright's Bar has been there through thick and thin, and that's certainly one of my favourite places. And so we used to meet a lot of people there, as well as in the, it was sort of unofficial senior dining room, perhaps, but it was also a place where we could meet students. Another very important place for socialising was the Robinson Room, which I don't know if other people have mentioned that, but that was a restaurant which was the first one that was deliberately staff and student mixed. It was named after L.G. Robinson, who'd been a dean of graduate students for many years, long before my time. And it was on the second floor of the main building, and that was a very favourite place. It was open in the evenings too. People who were doing evening dean duty got a free meal there up to 9 p.m. I think, and it was it was very, very popular, I'd say, especially for staff and students meeting. The staff otherwise stayed on the fifth floor with their SDR, and the students on the fourth floor with the refectory, which became the brunch bowl, which became the fourth floor restaurant.
While you were here, were you involved in networks or?
Well, I was thinking about that. It's an interesting question. I think all of them really were committees, and that was But they were so varied that I suppose they were different staff networks, if not recreational activities. Within the department, right from the very beginning, Adam Roberts, who was appointed at the same time as me, he and I alternated as chair of the staff student committee of the department and the staff rep on the Grimshaw Club, which was the student society in international relations, and at that time had a staff rep on its committee. Then I moved from that to representing the department on the Committee on Undergraduate Studies from 1970. And the first chairmanship I had was when that Committee on Undergraduate Studies decided to look at the state of the staff student committee system across the school. And I did that in 1984. And then I moved on from that until from 1992, I held more senior academic office, which involved some honorarium or what was actually more important, accelerated accumulation of sabbatical leave entitlement. So I, sabbatical leave has been enormously useful for my writing, I found. It's very difficult to get anything of great length and importance written other than in times of sabbatical leave, in my experience. And so one of the attractions of serving as a committee chair was the prospect of sabbatical leave afterwards. But I also enjoyed particularly the people I worked with across all departments. All departments were represented on the Undergraduate Admissions Committee, which I chaired from 1992 to 98, and the Academic Studies Committee, which looked after the undergraduate curriculum and regulations from 1993 to 98. And then I, in addition to chairing various of their subcommittees and working groups, particularly involving curriculum development, which is a special particular interest of mine, and degree structures and degree regulations, I returned to that role in a much more arduous committee to chair, which was the Teaching Quality Assurance Committee of 1999 to 2002, which benefited enormously from Simeon Underwood's appointment from 1st of August 2000 as our assistant registrar and later academic registrar. And then, having served in that capacity for 3 years and enjoyed sabbatical leave, I served at Simeon Underwood's particular request as chair of the Graduate School Board of Examiners from 2005 to 2009. And that was the first time that somebody other than a pro-director or deputy director had chaired that body, because it needed so much individual attention to try to sort out the enormously fast proliferating range of master's degree programs and to make sure that their examining boards, even if they weren't all standardized, were at least consistent in applying rules. And there were inevitably a lot of individual cases to sort out and appeals. And I dealt with a lot of very, very difficult cases, with the benefit of having done that as chair of the Academic Studies Committee for the undergraduates in 1993 to 98, when I was forever being asked to approve a suspension of regulations or a deviation from the curriculum, an unusual combination of subjects, for instance, and I'd make sure that it was well reasoned and supported by the department and wasn't going to create all sorts of unfairnesses for other people. So I enjoyed doing that, and I'd say I'd done that for the undergraduates. I then did that for the graduates in respect of examination regulations and outcomes and appeals from 2005 to 2009. And I met some wonderful people in doing that, and as I say, that was a very good way of meeting people across all the departments, because they were all represented on those bodies.
That sounds quite satisfying, because it sounds like you're actually affecting real change in school rather than just teaching your subject, doing research—it's an extra, it's an extra responsibility, but it's also very impactful.
Yes, it was sufficiently different to be a contrast to the work inside the department. It had benefits, obviously, in terms of getting me more sabbatical leave, so I could write more books and long articles than I would otherwise have been able to do. It also, I think, helped refresh me for work in the department when I returned from sabbatical leave. the department was always very important to me, and we moved around the place. Could I say a bit about that, perhaps? When I started, my first year, I was actually sharing a room, and one of the positives has been that I'm one of the perhaps rather few people who's been able to have my own office ever after. But for the first year, I shared a room, and that was in Lincoln Chambers, 3 Portsmouth Street, which at that time was the northern boundary of the school. There was nothing in Lincoln's Inn Fields, where the student centre is now with St Philip's Hospital, and we were a little outpost to the north. And after 4 terms there, I moved into the East Building, and all of International Relations Department were there from 1970 through to 1980. Then we moved to the back of the main building, the old W.H. Smith Memorial Hall. And in 1996, after 16 years there, we were able to move to Clement House, right at the end of the Aldwych. And that was a particularly far-sighted move. Chris Hill, who was then the convener of the department, was the only person who really saw the possibilities of what had been for years a very empty office block built for an insurance company back in 1912. It was incredibly dusty and grimy, and it was partitioned all wrong, but he could see the possibilities. And International Relations was the one department which was the right size in terms of number of staff and actually wanted to move there. And we were warned we'd be right on the outside of everything, we'd be cutting ourselves off from the mainstream of the school, completely untrue. And thanks to Chris Hill leading us into Clement House, I think the department went on to flourish. I was very happy for my last 14 years, 1996 to 2010, we were all in Clement House. The other person who's been very important in the development of the department I wanted to mention, as well as Chris Hill as the convener at that time, and probably my closest colleague as well on the academic side, was Hilary Parker, the departmental manager. She came in 1976 as departmental secretary. She's now in her 40th year and moved up to departmental administrator and now for many years departmental manager. And I've seen the importance of that continuity because conveners, and they're now called heads of department, serve for only 3 years at a time. There's a lot of movement among the academic staff, comings and goings. And the role of the departmental manager, certainly in international relations, has been enormously important. It's also expanded as budgets have expanded. And thinking back to the departmental meetings we had in the 1960s and 70s, they were mostly about teaching and degree structures and the curriculum and syllabus and that sort of thing. They weren't about money because the department had hardly any money under its own control. And as budgets have expanded, so has the amount of administration. And from having started as the departmental secretary with just 2 assistants on the admin side, Hilary Parker's now departmental manager with lots and lots of assistants on the admin and financial side and controlling very large budgets. So I think that's been very, very important. I suspect the role of departmental managers has been somewhat underrated in the history of the school. Certainly, Simeon Underwood, in his retirement speech in July 2015, said that one thing that he regretted was that the school didn't make enough use of its departmental managers' collective wisdom. It ought to integrate them much more into its decision-making because they do have such a reservoir of wisdom among them. And certainly that would be true of Hilary Parker. I had lots and lots of other excellent colleagues, but I do single out Chris Hill for leading us into Clement House when very few other people could see the advantages of it in 1996. And the International Relations Department is still there now. And Hilary Parker for the continuity that she's provided over 40 years as now the departmental manager.
In terms of that, in terms of the continuity of having a departmental manager with the same departmental manager or it being in the same location, what do you think the future of LSE is going to look like as so many changes happen?
Well, I think it's going to become more and more international. I think the chances of ever reintegrating it with the English education system are very, very slight, and there isn't much of an English education system anyway because it's become very much a competitive free market. I would hope that the school would not forget its undergraduates. There's been a risk at various times in its history of it becoming an all-graduate institution, and that's been resisted very fiercely by those of us who actually enjoy undergraduate teaching. I very much hope it will retain a very sizable undergraduate school. I say that's where I got some of the most greatest satisfaction, was from teaching and tutoring undergraduates and from the committee chairing in what became the undergraduate school in 1992 to 98. I think that the proportion, and I hope that obviously gender equality and also diversity in other ways will continue to flourish. I hope the greenery of the school will continue to flourish. It's extraordinary, the people and planet and other people who've awarded things to the school because of its efforts in greening itself and becoming far more environmentally sensitive than I would ever have imagined it could be in the smoke-filled rooms of the late 1960s. So I hope that it will continue on a green trajectory. I hope that it will also retain the sort of civility that I've seen among both the staff and the students, enormously tolerant of one another's different nationalities, was one thing which should never be taken for granted. And I remember the LSE Asian Society at a time when there were at least three wars between Asian countries all going on simultaneously in South and Southeast Asia. And the Asian students of different nationalities deliberately coming together and having social events to try to make sure that at LSE at least they had relations of civility with one another. And I've seen that again and again, particularly with difficult nationalities, that it hasn't always been perfect, but on the whole it's been very good. There's been a great respect for one another's integrity, I think I could say. And that's remained even as the staff and student composition has become, the staff and undergraduate student composition has become much less overwhelmingly British than it was when I started, and much less overwhelmingly male as well.
So actually, you've been quite succinct and have answered pretty much all my questions.
Oh dear.
But we, you know, if there's anything else you want to talk about or anything you feel like I haven't asked please feel free to let me know. And then if there's any question you feel like I haven't asked you, anything that you'd like to talk about that I haven't touched.
Right. Well, some of the things that now seem most antiquated, I thought I'd like to mention. When I was appointed, there was a 30-mile rule. Lecturers had to live within 30 miles of the school buildings. And I wrote a letter to Sir Walter Adams, who was then the director, and said, my fiancé and I are about to get married and we've bought a house at Gillingham in Kent and it's 31 miles from the school. Please may I have permission to waive condition, whatever it was, in my standard terms of contract. And Sir Walter Adams wrote a very nice letter back saying, yes, you may have permission, and wishing us well and wishing us a happy marriage and enjoying our home. And he had a flat in the Anchorage, that was the director's residence, the Anchorage. One of the porters doubled up as his driver in the school car and then trebled up as his butler to make the announcements when he held receptions for academic staff in the founder's room. And all those, I think, are sort of difficult to imagine now. The Paternoster lift in the Clare Market building, which was very alarming, especially as my first convener had a wooden leg and couldn't, very, very difficult for him to try and get near a paternoster lift, let alone get in or off it. The bindery seems, again, an extraordinary anachronism. There were still bookbinders employed by the school under the library, and, well, under the library administratively. Physically, they were under Lincoln Chambers. And so when the bindery finally closed and the library outsourced all its bookbinding, the bindery was converted to classrooms, and they were the smelliest classrooms anyone could imagine. Because all those centuries, well, decades of bookbinding that had gone on down there under Lincoln Chambers. There were institutions which would now be quite unthinkable because of the composition of the school having become so international. But back when it wasn't nearly so international, there was a committee on the welfare of overseas students, because overseas students were a minority and they needed their welfare specially cared for. There was a hospitality club, which was the wives of English male staff trying to provide some friendship to the wives of academics coming from overseas. As I say, the staff was overwhelmingly male at that time. It'd be very, very difficult to imagine those things now. And having you asked me which was, I don't have a favourite place around the school, certainly from teaching point of view, which was H206, which is now the finance department, PhD students, reading room, study room. And that's where I gave international institutions lectures year after year, and a particularly inspiring occasion with the LSE United Nations Society when the students invited me to give a talk at the beginning of the, in October 2007. And I'm not claiming credit for it, but it became the largest of all the students' union societies. And it grew very fast and did a wonderful job. And I found that really inspiring. I was returning after a period of sabbatical leave and writing a book, and that really set me up for the session, the enthusiasm of the students. And they were so bright and they were so intelligent, and I knew I was going to be meeting some of them in classes and seminars through the coming year, and I've kept up with one of the then president since and helped him in his career. But the other place apart from the teaching is the Founders Room, the Shaw Library, and that's been particularly important to me. First of all, from those director's receptions for academic staff, which were grand occasions with his butler in the early days, and then subsequently the retirements of George Kylo, who was an academic registrar from whom I'd helped appoint, who served from 1996 to 2005, then the retirement of Simeon Underwood just recently in 2015. But also my own in 2010. And so it means a lot to me, that place, because I remember the kind things that people said about me on my retirement and all the colleagues gathering around. So the Founders Room means a lot to me. And when I come into the school, I'm mostly in the Senior Common Room, but I like to go up to the Founders Room and sit there and contemplate and remember how fortunate I've been. I really enjoyed 42 years on the staff of the school, and now enjoying my retirement, 5 years into retirement, being able to come in and actually enjoy my leisure in the SCR or the Founders Room mainly.
One of the things that people have mentioned in these interviews is how much their ability to do research and seeing how much their job at LSE has changed over the years because of the change of technology. The technological revolution has just skyrocketed. Is that something that you felt in international relations in your own career?
Not in my own, but I don't think. I've worked from printed documents, diplomatic documents throughout, and books and articles in print. So it didn't really make much difference, I don't think. It did mean that when there was something like applying for readership or for accelerated double incrementation or something within the readership scale, Things like that. I needed a lot of technological help from a very kind administrator next door, Barbara King, in the next door office. She was able to manipulate these complicated documents in ways that I wouldn't have been able to. Without her, I'd never have got all the paperwork done for those last two promotions. But otherwise, no, the research side, I can see it's important, but I think there's been a great danger of it really overtaking the teaching function. And I think all universities are very aware of the difficulty for teaching of the overemphasis on research. And I think I've been fortunate that in my... I should have said that I came to work for the expectation of 42 years and hoping to attain promotion exactly halfway through, and that's what I did. We're all appointed into the career grade of lecturer at that time with no particular expectation of getting out of it, because 60% of all staff had to be kept in the lecturer grade. But I was hoping to be good enough at research and teaching and administration that all those things would help me to get promotion to a senior lectureship in 1989, exactly halfway through my time, and then within that last 21 years, further promotion again. So I was able to retire with emeritus readership, which is what I'd always looked forward to and hoped for. There's nothing else. That's fine for me, if that's all right for you.